"I'll be very glad to show you around," he said. "But I must confess I was a little surprised when Rupert passed on your request. I couldn't understand why one of you space hounds should be interested in our work. Aren't you going in the wrong direction?" He gave a little chuckle of amusement. "Personally, I've never seen why you were in such a hurry to get out there. It will be centuries before we've got everything in the oceans nicely charted and pigeonholed." Jan took a deep breath. He was glad that Sullivan had broached the subject himself, for it made his task that much easier. Despite the ichthyologist's jest, they had a great deal in common. It should not be too hard to build a bridge, to enlist Sullivan's sympathy and aid. He was a man of imagination, or he would never have invaded this underwater world. But Jan would have to be cautious, for the request he was going to make was, to say the least of it, somewhat unconventional. There was one fact that gave him confidence. Even if Sullivan refused to cooperate, he would certainly keep Jan's secret. And here, in this quiet little office on the bed of the Pacific, there seemed no danger that the overlords, whatever strange powers they possessed, would be able to listen to their conversation. "Professor Sullivan," he began, "if you were interested in the ocean, but the overlords refused to let you go near it, how would you feel?"
"Exceedingly annoyed, no doubt."
"I'm sure you would. And suppose one day you had a chance of achieving your goal, without them knowing, what would you do? Would you take the opportunity?" Sullivan never hesitated.
"Of course, and argue later."
"Right into my hands," thought Jan. "He can't retreat now, unless he's afraid of the overlords. And I doubt if Sullivan is afraid of anything." He leaned forward across the cluttered table and prepared to present his case. Professor Sullivan was no fool. Before Jan could speak, his lips twisted into a sardonic smile.
"So that's the game, is it?" he said slowly. "Very, very interesting. Now you go right ahead and tell me why I should help you."
Chapter 12. An earlier age would have regarded Professor Sullivan as an expensive luxury. His operations cost as much as a small war. Indeed, he could be likened to a general conducting a perpetual campaign against an enemy who never relaxed. Professor Sullivan's enemy was the sea, and it fought him with weapons of cold and darkness, and above all, pressure. In his turn, he countered his adversary with intelligence and engineering skill. He had won many victories, but the sea was patient. It could wait. One day, Sullivan knew, he would make a mistake. At least he had the consolation of knowing that he could never drown. It would be far too quick for that. He had refused to commit himself one way or the other when Jan made his request, but he knew what his answer was going to be. Here was the opportunity for a most interesting experiment. It was a pity that he would never know the result. Still, that happened often enough in scientific research, and he had initiated other programs that would take decades to complete. Professor Sullivan was a brave and an intelligent man, but looking back on his career, he was conscious of the fact that it had not brought him the sort of fame that sends a scientist's name safely down the centuries. Here was a chance, totally unexpected and all the more attractive for that, of really establishing himself in the history books. It was not an ambition he would ever have admitted to anybody, and to do him justice, he would still have helped Jan, even if his part in the plot remained forever secret. As for Jan, he was now having second thoughts. The momentum of his original discovery had carried him thus far almost without effort. He had made his investigations, but had taken no active steps to turn his dream into reality. In a few days, however, he must make his choice. If Professor Sullivan agreed to cooperate, there was no way in which he could retreat. He must face the future he had chosen, with all its implications. What finally decided him was the thought that, if he neglected this incredible opportunity, he would never forgive himself. All the rest of his life would be spent in vain regrets, and nothing could be worse than that. Sullivan's answer reached him a few hours later, and he knew that the die was cast. Slowly, because there was still plenty of time,
he began to put his affairs in order. "Dear Maya," the letter began, "this is going to be, to put it mildly, rather a surprise for you. When you get this letter, I shall no longer be on Earth. By that, I don't mean that I shall have gone to the moon, as many others have done. No, I shall be on my way to the home of the Overlords. I shall be the first man ever to leave the solar system. I am giving this letter to the friend who is helping me. He will hold it until he knows that my plan has succeeded, in its first phase at least, and that it is too late for the Overlords to interfere. I shall be so far away, and traveling at such a speed, that I doubt if any recall message can overtake me. Even if it could, it seems most unlikely that the ship would be able to put back to Earth. And I very much doubt if I'm all that important anyway. First, let me explain what led to this. You know that I've always been interested in spaceflight, and have always felt frustrated because we've never been allowed to go to the other planets, or to learn anything about the civilization of the Overlords. If they had never intervened, we might have reached Mars and Venus by now. I admit that it is equally probable that we would have destroyed ourselves with cobalt bombs and the other global weapons the 20th century was developing. Yet sometimes I wish we could have had a chance of standing on our own feet. Probably the Overlords have their reasons for keeping us in the nursery, and probably they are excellent reasons. But even if I knew what they were, I doubt if it would make much difference to my own feelings or my actions. Everything really began at that party of Rupert's. He doesn't know about this, by the way, though he put me on the right track. You remember that silly seance he arranged and how it ended when that girl, I forget her name, fainted? I'd asked what star the Overlords came from, and the reply was NGS-549672. I'd not expected any answer, and had treated the whole business as a joke until then. But when I realized that this was a number in a star catalog, I decided to look into it. I found that the star was in the constellation Carina, and one of the few facts that we do know about the Overlords is that they come from that direction. Now, I don't pretend to understand how that information reached us or where it originated. Did someone read Rashevarik's mind? Even if they had, it's hardly likely that he would have known the reference number of his son in one of our catalogs. It's a complete mystery, and I leave it to people like Rupert to solve, if they can. I'm just content to take the information and to act on it. We know a lot now, through our observations of their departure, about the speed of the Overlord ships. They leave the solar system under such tremendous accelerations that they approach the velocity of light in less than an hour. That means that the Overlords must possess some kind of propulsive system that acts equally on every atom of their ships, so that anything aboard won't be crushed instantly. I wonder why they employ such colossal accelerations when they've got all space to play with and could take their time picking up speed. My theory is that they can somehow tap the energy fields round the stars and so have to do their starting and stopping while they're fairly close to a sun. But that's all by the way. The important fact was that I knew how far they had to travel, and therefore how long the journey took. NGS-549672 is 40 light-years from Earth. The Overlord ships reach more than 99% of the speed of light, so the trip must last 40 years of our time. Our time. That's the crux of the matter. Now, as you may have heard, strange things happen as one approaches the speed of light. Time itself begins to flow at a different rate, to pass more slowly, so that what would be months on Earth would be no more than days on the ships of the Overlords. The effect is quite fundamental. It was discovered by the great Einstein more than 100 years ago. I have made calculations based on what we know about the star drive and using the firmly established results of the relativity theory. From the viewpoint of the passengers on one of the Overlord ships, the journey to NGS-549672 will last not more than 2 months, even though by Earth's reckoning, 40 years will have passed. I know this seems a paradox, and if it's any consolation, it's puzzled the world's best brains ever since Einstein announced it. Perhaps this example will show you the sort of thing that can happen, and will give you a clearer picture of the situation. If the Overlords send me straight back to Earth, I shall arrive home having aged only 4 months. But on Earth itself, 80 years will have passed. So you understand, Maya, that whatever happens, this is goodbye. I have few ties binding me here, as you know well enough, so I can leave with a clear conscience. I've not told Mother yet. She would get hysterical, and I couldn't face that. It's better this way. Though I've tried to make allowances ever since Father died, oh, there's no point now in going into all that again. I've terminated my studies and told the authorities that for family reasons, I'm moving to Europe. Everything has been settled, and there should be nothing for you to worry about. By this time, you may imagine that I'm crazy, since it seems impossible for anyone to get into one of the Overlord ships, but I found a way. It doesn't happen very often, and after this it may never happen again, for I'm sure Karelin never makes the same mistake twice. Do you know the legend of the wooden horse that got the Greek soldiers into Troy? But there's a story from the Old Testament that's an even closer parallel.
"He'll certainly be much more comfortable than Jonah," said Sullivan. "There is no evidence that he was provided with electric light or sanitation. But you'll need a lot of provisions, and I see you're taking oxygen. Can you take enough for a 2 months' voyage in such a small space?"
He stubbed his finger on the careful sketches which Jan had laid on the table. The microscope acted as a paperweight at one end, the skull of some improbable fish held down the other.
"I hope the oxygen isn't necessary," said Jan. "We know that they can breathe our atmosphere, but they don't seem to like it very much, and I might not be able to manage theirs at all. As for the supply situation, using narcosamine solves that. It's perfectly safe. When we're underway, I'll take a shot that will knock me out for 6 weeks, plus or minus a few days. I'll be nearly there by then. Actually, it wasn't the food and oxygen that was worrying me, so much as the boredom."
Professor Sullivan nodded thoughtfully.
"Yes, narcosamine is safe enough and can be calibrated fairly accurately. But mind, you've got plenty of food handy. You'll be ravening when you wake up, and as weak as a kitten. Suppose you starved to death because you hadn't the strength to use a can opener."
"I'd thought of that," said Jan, a little hurt. "I'll work up through sugar and chocolate in the usual way."
"Good. I'm glad to see that you've been into the problem thoroughly, and are treating it like some stunt you can back out of if you don't like the way it's going. It's your life you're playing with, but I'd hate to feel I was helping you commit suicide."
He picked up the skull and lifted it absent-mindedly in his hands. Jan grabbed the plan to prevent it rolling up.
"Luckily," continued Professor Sullivan, "the equipment you need is all fairly standard, and our shop can put it together in a few weeks. And if you decide to change your mind..."
"I won't," said Jan. "I've considered all the risks I'm taking, and there seems to be no flaw in the plan. At the end of 6 weeks, I'll emerge like any other stowaway and give myself up. By then, in my time, remember, the journey will be nearly over. We will be about to land in the world of the Overlords. Of course, what happens then is up to them. Probably I'll be sent home on the next ship, but at least I can expect to see something. I've got a 4mm camera and thousands of meters of film. It won't be my fault if I can't use it. Even at the worst, I'll have proved that man can't be kept in quarantine forever. I'll have created a precedent that will compel Karelin to take some action. That, my dear Maya, is all I have to say. I know you won't miss me greatly. Let's be honest and admit that we never had very strong ties. And now that you've married Rupert, you'll be quite happy in your own private universe. At least I hope so. Goodbye, then, and good luck. I shall look forward to meeting your grandchildren. Make sure that they know about me, won't you? Your affectionate brother, Jan." Chapter 13. When Jan first saw it, he found it hard to realize that he was not watching the fuselage of a small airliner being assembled. The metal skeleton was 20 meters long, perfectly streamlined, and surrounded by light scaffolding over which the workmen were clamoring with their power tools.
"Yes," said Sullivan in reply to Jan's question.
We use standard aeronautical techniques, and most of these men are from the aircraft industry. It's hard to believe that a thing this size could be alive, isn't it? Or could throw itself clear out of the water, as I've seen them do. It was all very fascinating, but Jan had other things on his mind. His eyes were searching the giant skeleton to find a suitable hiding place for his little cell. The air-conditioned coffin, as Sullivan had christened it. On one point, he was immediately reassured. As far as space was concerned, there would be room for a dozen stowaways. "The framework looks nearly complete," said Jan. "When will you be putting on the skin? I suppose you've already caught your whale, or you wouldn't know how large to make the skeleton." Sullivan seemed highly amused by this remark. "We haven't the slightest intention of catching a whale. Anyway, they don't have skins in the usual sense of the word. It would hardly be practicable to fold a blanket of blubber 20 centimeters thick around that framework. No, the whole thing will be faked up with plastics and then accurately painted. By the time we've finished, no one will be able to tell the difference." In that case, thought Jan, the sensible thing for the overlords to have done would be to take photographs and make the full-sized model themselves, back on their home planet. But perhaps their supply ships returned empty, and a little thing like a 20-meter sperm whale would hardly be noticed. When one possessed such power and such resources, one could not be bothered with minor economies. Professor Sullivan stood by one of the great statues that had been such a challenge to archaeology since Easter Island was discovered. King, God, or whatever it might be, its eyeless gaze seemed to be following his as he looked upon his handiwork. He was proud of what he had done. It seemed a pity that it would soon be banished forever from human sight. The tableau might have been the work of some mad artist in a drugged delirium, yet it was the painstaking copy from life. Nature herself was the artist here. The scene was one that, until the perfection of underwater television, few men had ever glimpsed, and even then only for seconds on those rare occasions when the giant antagonists thrashed their way to the surface. These battles were fought in the endless night of the ocean depths, where the sperm whales hunted for their food. It was food that objected strongly to being eaten alive. The long, saw-toothed lower jaw of the whale was gaping wide, preparing to fasten upon its prey. The creature's head was almost concealed beneath the writhing network of white, pulpy arms with which the giant squid was fighting desperately for life. Livid sucker marks, 20 centimeters or more in diameter, had mottled the whale's skin where those arms had fastened. One tentacle was already a truncated stump, and there could be no doubt as to the ultimate outcome of the battle. When the two greatest beasts on Earth engaged in combat, the whale was always the winner. For all the vast strength of its forest of tentacles, the squid's only hope lay in escaping before that patiently grinding jaw had sawn it to pieces. Its great expressionless eyes, half a meter across, stared at its destroyer, though, in all probability, neither creature could see the other in the darkness of the abyss. The entire exhibit was more than 30 meters long, and had now been surrounded by a cage of aluminum girders to which the lifting tackle had been connected. Everything was ready, awaiting the overlord's pleasure. Sullivan hoped that they would act quickly. The suspense was beginning to be uncomfortable. Someone had come out of the office into the bright sunlight, obviously looking for him. Sullivan recognized his chief clerk and walked over to meet him.
"Hello, Bill. What's the fuss?"
The other was holding a message form and looked rather pleased.
"Some good news, Professor. We've been honored. The supervisor himself wants to come and look at our tableau before it's shipped off. Just think of the publicity we'll get. It will help a lot when we apply for our new grant. I'd been hoping for something like this."
Professor Sullivan swallowed hard. He never objected to publicity, but this time he was afraid he might get altogether too much. Karelin stood by the head of the whale and looked up at the great, blunt snout and the ivory-studded jaw. Sullivan, concealing his unease, wondered what the supervisor was thinking. His behavior had not hinted at any suspicion, and the visit could be easily explained as a normal one. but Sullivan would be very glad when it was over.
"We've no creatures as large as this on our planet," said Karelin. "That is one reason why we asked you to make this group. My, compatriots will find it fascinating."
"With your low gravity," answered Sullivan, "I should have thought you would have had some very large animals. After all, look how much bigger you are than us."
"Yes, but we have no oceans, and where size is concerned, the land can never compete with the sea."
That was perfectly true, thought Sullivan, and as far as he knew, this was a hitherto unrevealed fact about the world of the overlords. Jan, confound him, would be very interested. At that moment, that young man was sitting in a hut a kilometer away, anxiously watching the inspection through field glasses. He kept telling himself that there was nothing to fear. No inspection of the whale, however close, could reveal its secret. But there was always the chance that Karelin suspected something, and was playing with them. It was a suspicion that was growing in Sullivan's mind as the supervisor peered into the cavernous throat.
"In your Bible," said Karelin, "there is a remarkable story of a Hebrew prophet, one Jonah, who was swallowed by a whale and thus carried safely to land after he had been cast from a ship. Do you think there could be any basis of fact in such a legend?"
"I believe," Sullivan replied cautiously, "that there is one fairly well-authenticated case of a whaleman being swallowed and then regurgitated with no ill effects. Of course, if he had been inside the whale for more than a few seconds, he would have suffocated, and he must have been very lucky to miss the teeth. It's an almost incredible story, but not quite impossible."
"Very interesting," said Karelin.
He stood for another moment, staring at the great jaw, then moved on to examine the squid. Sullivan hoped he did not hear his sigh of relief.
"If I'd known what I was going to go through," said Professor Sullivan, "I'd have thrown you out of the office as soon as you tried to infect me with your insanity."
"I'm sorry about that," Jan replied, "but we've got away with it."
"I hope so. Good luck, anyway. If you want to change your mind, you've still got at least 6 hours."
"I won't need them. Only Karelin can stop me now. Thanks for all that you've done. If I ever get back and write a book about the overlords, I'll dedicate it to you."
"Much good that will do me," said Sullivan gruffly. "I'll have been dead for years."
To his surprise and mild consternation, for he was not a sentimental man, he discovered that this farewell was beginning to affect him. He had grown to like Jan during the weeks they had plotted together. Moreover, he had begun to fear he might be an accessory to a complicated suicide. He steadied the ladder as Jan climbed into the great jaw, carefully avoiding the lines of teeth. By the light of the electric torch, he saw Jan turn and wave before he was lost in the cavernous hollow. There was the sound of the airlock hatch being opened and closed, and thereafter, silence. In the moonlight that had transformed the frozen battle into a scene from a nightmare, Professor Sullivan walked slowly back to his office. He wondered what he had done and where it would lead. But this, of course, he would never know. Jan might walk this spot again, having given no more than a few months of his life in traveling to the home of the overlords and returning to Earth. Yet if he did so, it would be on the other side of time's impassable barrier, for it would be 80 years in the future. The lights went on in the tiny metal cylinder as soon as Jan had closed the inner door of the lock. He allowed himself no time for second thoughts, but began immediately upon the routine check he had already worked out. All the stores and provisions had been loaded days ago, but a final recheck would put him in the right frame of mind by assuring him that nothing had been left undone. An hour later, he was satisfied. He lay back on the sponge rubber couch and recapitulated his plans. The only sound was the faint whir of the electric calendar clock, which would warn him when the voyage was coming to its end. He knew that he could expect to feel nothing here in his cell, for whatever tremendous forces drove the ships of the overlords must be perfectly compensated. Sullivan had checked that, pointing out that his tableau would collapse if subjected to more than a few gravities. His clients had assured him that there was no danger on this score. There would, however, be a considerable change of atmospheric pressure. This was unimportant, since the hollow models could breathe through several orifices. Before he left his cell, Jan would have to equalize pressure, and he had assumed that the atmosphere inside the Overlord ship was unbreathable. A simple face mask and oxygen set would take care of that. There was no need for anything elaborate. If he could breathe without mechanical aid, so much the better. There was no point in waiting any longer. It would only be a strain on the nerves. He took out the little syringe, already loaded with the carefully prepared solution. Narcosamine had been discovered during research into animal hibernation. It was not true to say, as was popularly believed, that it produced suspended animation. All it caused was a great slowing down of the vital processes, though metabolism still continued at a reduced level. It was as if one had banked up the fires of life so that they smoldered underground. But when, after weeks or months, the effect of the drug wore off, they would burst out again and the sleeper would revive. Narcosamine was perfectly safe. Nature had used it for 1,000,000 years to protect many of her children from the foodless winter. So Jan slept. He never felt the tug of the hoisting cables as the huge metal framework was lifted into the hold of the Overlord freighter. He never heard the hatches close, not to open again for 300,000,000,000 kilometers. He never heard, far off and faint through the mighty walls, the protesting scream of Earth's atmosphere as the ship climbed swiftly back to its natural element. And he never felt the star drive go on. Chapter 14. The conference room was always crowded for these weekly meetings, but today it was so closely packed that the reporters had difficulty in writing. For the 100th time, they grumbled to each other at Corellan's conservatism and lack of consideration. Anywhere else in the world, they could have brought TV cameras, tape recorders, and all the other tools of their highly mechanized trade. But here, they had to rely on such archaic devices as paper and pencil, and even, incredible to relate, shorthand. There had, of course, been several attempts to smuggle in recorders. They had been successfully smuggled out again, but a single glance at their smoking interiors had shown the futility of the experiment. Everyone understood, then, why they had always been warned, in their own interest, to leave watches and other metallic objects outside the conference room. To make things more unfair, Corellan himself recorded the whole proceedings. Reporters guilty of carelessness or downright misrepresentation, though this was very rare, had been summoned to short and unpleasant sessions with Corellan's underlings and had been required to listen attentively to playbacks of what the supervisor had really said. The lesson was not one that ever had to be repeated. It was strange how these rumors got around. No prior announcement was made, yet there was always a full house whenever Corellan had an important statement to make, which happened, on the average, 2 or 3 times a year. Silence descended on the murmuring crowd as the great doorway split open and Corellan came forward onto the dais. The light here was dim, no doubt approximating that of the Overlord's far distant sun, so that the supervisor for Earth had discarded the dark glasses he normally wore when in the open. He replied to the ragged chorus of greetings with a formal, "Good morning, everybody," then turned to the tall, distinguished figure at the front of the crowd. Mr. Golda, doyen of the press club, might have been the original inspirer of the butler's announcement.
"Two reporters, my lord, and a gentleman from the Times."
He dressed and behaved like a diplomat of the old school. No one would ever hesitate to confide in him, and no one had ever regretted it subsequently.
"Quite a crowd today, Mr. Golda. There must be a shortage of news."
The gentleman from the Times smiled and cleared his throat.
"I hope you can rectify that, Mr. Supervisor."
He watched intently as Corellan considered his reply. It seemed so unfair that the Overlord's faces, rigid as masks, betrayed no trace of emotion. the great wide eyes, their pupils sharply contracted even in this indifferent light, stared fathomlessly back into the frankly curious human ones. The twin breathing orifices on either cheek, if those fluted, basalt curves could be called cheeks, emitted the faintest of whistles as Karelin's hypothetical lungs labored in the thin air of Earth. Golda could just see the curtain of tiny white hairs fluttering to and fro, keeping accurately out of phase as they responded to Karelin's rapid, double-action breathing cycle. Dust filters, they were generally believed to be, and elaborate theories concerning the atmosphere of the Overlord's home had been constructed on this slender foundation.